Hello, I'm Rafik, and you're watching the Garbled Twistery Channel.
Hello, dogs and cats and adorable bats. You're listening to another rooty-tooty, fun-filled episode of Garbled Twistery. And boy, have I got a treat for you. Today, we're going to be looking at our fourth 1789 presidential candidate, John. The fourth John. The last John in the race. The John with the handwriting that makes English actually look like a desirable language. Johnny Hanikake! Usual disclaimer, if he ever becomes a candidate again after 1789, I will be posting this episode yet again, but I'll tell you where the updated part is about his freaking life, okay? All right. So, where does this story begin? Well, Johnny Hanikake was a wee lad living his life in Braintree. His dad was named Johnny Hanikake, and his dad's dad was named Johnny Hanikake, making this Johnny Hanikake actually Johnny Hanikake version 3. Anyways, do you remember the other 1789 presidential candidate who was chilling in Braintree? Here's a refresher. His name rhymes with jury duty. Dum, 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 dum. It's Johnny Adams! And you know what? Johnny Hanikake's mommy, Mary, actually set up a whole bunch of playdates and stuff. Quote, "Oh my goodness, hi Susanna, it's so nice to see you. We should totally go out for brunch this weekend. You've just got to bring little Johnny A over. It'll be a nice little play date for the kids, and who knows, maybe they'll be BFFs," unquote. Yeah, I have a feeling these two Johnnies ended up only as, like, acquaintances at best. Seriously, what is it with moms and forced playdates? Anyways, Johnny Hanikake version 3's dad kicked the bucket when he was like 7, so he had to go live with his uncle, Tommy Hanikake, who was this big old hotshot merchant who ran this firm called the House of Hanikake. Let me tell ya, Tommy Hanikake had like all the money in Boston, and everybody knew that. So Johnny Hanikake grew up living that Wizard Kelly life, if you know what I mean. If you don't know what that means he went to freaking hyper-expensive bougie Latin school and then went straight to Harvard after that. And then after Harvard, he went to go work for Uncle Tommy, making a whole bunch of money and buying a whole bunch of fancy-pantsy expensive sandals and stuff. And when his uncle died, he got thousands of acres of land. John Hancock? More like Johnny Moneybags. Did he have slaves? Well, none in his name. You see, when his dad was alive, they had one slave in the house doing the dishes for free. When his Uncle Tommy died, he had like 3. But they were like inherited from his uncle or whatever, and they ended up being freed because whatever was written in Uncle Tommy's will expired, and Johnny didn't really care enough about literally owning people to go and renew his slaves. The thing is, Johnny Hanikake was rich and all that jazz, making him kind of a weirdo. Like, he joined the Freemasons, who were a secret club of people with a lot of money who threw that money at each other, and now everybody thinks they're still around, poisoning the water supply and worshipping Voldemort and pricking the eyebrow hairs of children, or whatever. Oh, and of course, he spent a year in England doing money stuff. Every wealthy human does that at least once in their life. Right.
What a weirdo.
Anyways, we're around that time where England wasted all their money on passive-aggressive postcards during that Seven Years' War thing. And who were they expecting to pay the bill for these passive-aggressive postcards? The colonists, of course! So they started just, like, taxing everybody for everything, and as we know full well by now, everybody was losing their minds because the tea-sippers didn't ask permission to start throwing those taxes out there. Well, everyone was losing their minds except Johnny Hanikake. He didn't care as much about all this representation stuff. Now, this Johnny guy simply didn't like the money aspect of it. From his perspective, T-Lan was totally trying to scam the people. I mean, the people still liked him enough to elect him as one of the head honchos of Boston, though. When that Stamp Act came around, at first, Johnny Hanny Cocky was trying to, like, shrug his shoulders a little bit about it. I mean, he really liked London, and he was really bougie.
So bougie.
He eventually realized he couldn't just shrug his shoulders about it, but he still didn't like all the ghastly tarring and feathering that was happening. But he showed up at a cute little boycott, and then soon after that, he ended up in the freaking House of Reps for Boston. I know you've been wondering, how exactly did Johnny Hanny Cocky rise up in the political world so quickly? Was it the Freemasons? No. This is not that kind of podcast. I have standards. The reason Johnny got so political so fast is because of this political dude named Sammy Adams. Like, Sammy was 15 years older, and he didn't like bougie things at all. Like, he was pretty much a straight-up Puritan. Yet, he was showing Johnny the political ropes. Or using Johnny's bouginess to pull the political strings. What you think of this is completely up to you. Nobody gets it. I don't get it. Historians don't get it. What they had was something special or something. Because nobody gets it. So, some time passes, and the tea sippers get this brilliant idea to make more money without trying the whole stamps thingy. They knew that the colonies had this major smuggling problem that, like, wasn't even a problem. Like, there was a whole culture around it and stuff. But the tea sippers, they needed the money. So they figured they ought to put a lid on all this smuggling nonsense to do it. How? By passing the Townshend Act. Yes, that'll work. But it didn't. Strengthening customs for the boats only annoyed people, and Johnny Hanny Cocky was one of the dudes leading the new, improved boycotts. The thing is, when you're being disobedient but also have a whole lot of money, the government's gonna target you. It's just gonna happen. They might have thought Johnny was a smuggler, but they probably just hated his guts. So one day, Johnny's just hanging out on his ship. He named it Lydia. Nice name for a nice ship, I guess. And customs shows up and is all like, Johnny Hancock, come upstairs. We need to have a little chat. So Johnny carefully puts away his teacups he was painting at the time and goes upstairs to see customs. The customs guys are all like, hello, routine bolt check, we'll be up at 5. But Johnny was all like, you got a warrant, cause this isn't routine. And then the two customs officials were all like, oh, okay. Awkward silence. Then the customs dudes try to charge into the freaking boat, and one of them gets in, but Hancock's posse pushes them right out, and it's crazy, and everybody's all frustrated. So, after this fiasco, the two customs officials tried to press charges, but the judge was like, quote, Johnny didn't do anything wrong. You idiots. Get a freaking warrant next time. Jeez Louise. Unquote. Later on, the Johnny Hanny Cocky fan club would say that this was the first act of physical resistance to the tea sippers, and therefore Johnny Hanny Cocky single-handedly started the American Revolution. What? I think they're reading too much into it. It feels a lot more like a petty Judge Judy kind of situation, if you know what I'm talking about. But whatever. Something else happened on one of his other boats that was even more crazy, okay? So this boat, named the Liberté, was coming back from a trip carrying some nice Madeira wine, Johnny's favorite.
Yummy.
Customs officers showed up the morning after, and they, like, checked out the wine load, and, seemed a little light. It seemed a little light. I mean, they couldn't prove anything, really, but they suspected Johnny unloaded some of the wine in the middle of the night, so he would have to pay less in the morning, but they couldn't prove anything, though. If anything like that did happen, nobody was talking. Honestly, these customs guys were probably just doing this to be freaking annoying. But then, a month later, somebody on Johnny's ship starts running his mouth. Quote, They got the rope that was sitting on the deck, and they tied my hands and legs to a pole, and I had to sit there and watch as they were illegally unloading the wine. Oh, the horror! Are you gonna pay me for this confession or what?
Unquote. So yeah, the customs guys freaking seized that boat.
Now, the hot topic of the day was this thing called impressment, which was basically the tea sippers forcefully throwing colonists into the British Navy, which kind of violated the British Constitution. But the captain of the visiting ship named the Romney was, like, literally doing this impressment nonsense to the colonists. And he was the guy that got the confession. Everybody in Boston was already miffed about this issue. And then Johnny's boat is freaking seized by this law-breaking Englishman. And then Johnny's boat starts getting towed, which was also kind of illegal. And the dudes who were trying to seize the boat were mistaken for the thugs who were hired to go around beating people up to force them into the military. And everybody goes bananas, and it was a riot. The customs people just kind of ran away, writing letters about how dangerous Boston is, but everybody thought they were being freaking melodramatic and wanted the tea sippers to just freaking send a bunch of troops to snoop around. The customs people also lawyered up, probably because they wanted that Hane Kake Mula. They were able to get the ship confiscated and used it for, like, trading and stuff until a bunch of angry, angry people burned it freaking down in Rhode Island or something. And then another trial happened for the unloaded wine. And if Johnny lost, he'd have to pay freaking triple the price of the wine he, quote-unquote, illegally unloaded. Anyways, who do you think Johnny called to be his lawyer? Humphrey Plowjogger, of course. It's a good thing his mom forced Johnny H and Johnny A to have those freaking playdates, am I right? However, at this point, Johnny Adams was a hot shot lawyer. So this made the trial super public and super weird, where there was like no jury and sometimes the cross-examination was skipped. But come on. It's Johnny Adams we're talking about. The charges were dropped without any freaking explanation. Yeah, Johnny Adams was that freaking good. Sure, the charges were dropped, but people still get into insane freaking arguments about whether Johnny Hanikaki was a smuggler or not. Like, on one hand, he was completely victimized by the tea sippers. On the other hand, he had a lot of money and could probably cut corners if he wanted to. Everybody else was doing it. What makes him special? Yeah, you decide. Nobody really knows what actually happened that day. Even if you went in a time machine and asked people what happened with Johnny's freaking boat, you wouldn't know the truth. It's one of those things, you know? I mean, people called him the King of Smugglers later on, but like, there's no evidence that he smuggled at all. But, like, that could also mean he was good enough to burn all the tapes, you know? He sure had the money to do it. I'll say it again.
You decide.
So, like, the tea sippers were mad for a whole slew of reasons, not just Johnny's freaking boat incident. Like, there was this rabble-rouser named Sammy Adams, remember him? Who was throwing around this circular pamphlet that said a big fat screw England on it. And you know what, the tea sippers had just had it with Massachusetts at this point. So they sent in the troops. Things got even crazier. Everybody was yelling and like throwing rocks and stuff. And the next thing you know, 5 civilians are shot to death and it's a PR disaster. A massacre in Boston, I tell ya. And while Johnny Hanikaki wasn't freaking there, he happened to be nosy and annoying, which means he was the guy who spearheaded the committee to remove the civilian killing soldiers. No, but really, like, he freaking sat in a boardroom with a whole bunch of British officials and was all like, quote, "If you don't remove those civilian killing cretins, I'll have 10,000 people who are gonna charge into Boston and we'll do it ourselves," unquote. Okay, this was the most obvious idiotic bluff in U.S. history so far. Like, imagine you're in a meeting with your boss, and your boss is all like, this desk costs 900 quintillion dollars. Like, that's how dumb Johnny Hancock sounded, and I wish I could have been in the room so I could call him out on his blatant tomfoolery. What's more infuriating is that everybody was all like, John Hancock did such a great job scaring those tea-sipping meanie heads away. Let's re-elect him. I can 100% assure you that Johnny Hancock's absurd, melodramatic bluff had absolutely nothing to do with the very real reasons why England took the Boston Massacrers out of town. But he got re-elected for it. After that whole fiasco, everything got calmer. Nobody was throwing rocks at each other anymore. But don't get me wrong, everybody was still casually checking each other's trash cans for dirt. Like, it was still tense. And Johnny tried to cozy up with Tommy Hutchinson, the super British governor of Massachusetts Bay, and it worked. Johnny landed himself a spot in the Massachusetts Council of Governors. I mean, Johnny, of course, refused to take the spot. He's manipulative, but he's not a snake. The only reason Tommy Hutchinson wanted to be friends was to try and break up Johnny's friendship with Sammy Adams anyways, so the manipulation was going both ways, dude. And for a hot second, everybody thought that there indeed was a freaking breakup. Because when Sammy created the Committee of Correspondence, Johnny was being all petty and didn't freaking join. But, like, there wasn't a breakup. Because they, like, teamed up and leaked Tommy Hutchinson's freaking mail to his pen pals. Oh, so you want to know about the mail. What did Hutchinson write in them, you ask, in his letters? Quote, look, these patriots are being ungrateful brats, and we probably have to bend the rules and break some legs to get them to obey like the feral dogs they are. Unquote. Yeah, Tommy wasn't the governor for long after that. Yikes.
Oh my goodness.
So next, England slaps this freaking tea tax on top of everything and everybody goes crazy again. And so does Johnny Hancock. Like, he's having these meetings and stuff where he's all like, quote, look, if you like paying more than you have to for your freaking tea, then you aren't a true American and you're a traitor and you should probably swim back to traitor land where you can get all the overpriced tea you want, unquote. Like, he wanted to stop the freaking tea at all costs, trying to get dudes fired and stuff. And when he couldn't get people fired, he basically told everybody to do whatever they can to stop the freaking tea! I mean, he wasn't there for the big fat tea party, but he liked it. But he didn't directly say he liked it because he didn't want to say he liked destroying private property. What a crafty little bougie politician you are, Johnny. Anyways, he got the gout, and the gout got worse. But he was able to squeak out another speech on the 4th annual massacre anniversary. Quote, all these freeloading soldiers hanging around are just Parliament's derpy stormtroopers. Nothing more. Unquote. I mean, okay, Johnny Hancock, but they're not the ones who are walking around with the gout. So, like, after the tea party, England was quite peeved, if you know what I mean. Like, Hutchinson got freaking fired and he was replaced by some psycho named Tommy Gage. And Johnny Hancocky was immediately fired from his spot in the governor's back pocket or whatever. And he couldn't even make it to the freaking First Continental Congress because he still had the gout, yo. Yeah, but Tommy Gage was a no-nonsense loyalist. So he canceled any and all meetings where things could be, like, you know, smoothed over. The angry patriots of Massachusetts responded by making their own freaking Congress that had nothing to do with tea land, and Johnny Hancocky was the first boss man they chose, of course. They even threw a bunch of guns at people and started training them to be ready to shoot some tea sippers within a minute's notice. Things were getting serious, man. So when Continental Congress Con Part 2 happened, Massachusetts noticed that his gout wasn't hurting too bad, so they sent him. I mean, they only did it because the other guy was sicker than Johnny somehow. But still, he got to go. But no, like, you see, everyone re-elected Johnny Hancocky as president of freaking Massachusetts. Like, the dude had money and power up the wazoo, okay? Like, he had to take his buddy Sammy Adams and hide in the freaking old house that Johnny grew up in, because those dastardly tea sippers just wouldn't freaking give any gosh darn privacy. My goodness. I mean, they had every right to be afraid, because, like, Tommy Gage had straight up orders from headquarters to arrest everybody in the new Congress who was being extra ungrateful. I mean, the only reason Tommy didn't do it was because he wanted the PR advantage. But the New England Patriots didn't freaking notice, so they sent their most obnoxious human, Paulie, careening on a freaking pony to tell Johnny to hide his kids and hide his wife because the British were coming. I have Johnny Hancock's response right here. Quote, put him up, unquote. Luckily, Sammy was there to remind Johnny that he was rich and powerful and that that was more valuable than his free will or whatever. Then while they were running away, some shots were fired at Lexington and Concord, and not long after that, our old friend Tommy Gage opened up a group chat. Quote, look, if you drop all your guns and surrender now, it'll all be water off a duck's back, and everything will be alright, unless you're John Hancock or Samuel Adams, those ungrateful doo-doo-dunderheads, unquote. Yeah. Being tagged as unforgivable in that statement got Johnny Hancocky and Sammy Adams some serious street cred. Or should I say, it only increased the insane amounts of street cred they already had. And let me tell you right now, that street cred came in mighty handy, especially when Johnny went to the Continental Congressy thingy, because they elected him as the presidency of the Continental Congress unanimously. He had money and he was bougie, so the conservative peeps liked him, but he was a rabble rouser, so the super patriots liked him too. I mean, I don't know if he liked the job as fancy as it was, because he had to do a lot of official paperworky things. Like, so much paperwork that he had to hire an army of interns. I mean, whatever gets his job done, though. Anyways, Johnny Hancocky did have a spoiled brat, poor sport side of him, though. Probably because all that power and everybody liking him kind of got to his head a little. Why do I say that? Well, according to Johnny Adams, when Jorge Washington became the commander-in-chief of the whole darn Patriot Army, Johnny Hancocky started walking around, looking at the floor and murmuring under his breath like a jealous jackal. I mean, some people think Johnny carried this jealousy around all the time with him, but most experts think Johnny Hancocky was probably upset for like a week at most, but then got over it like a regular, sane adult. He even named his kid John George Washington Hancock. But maybe it's a messiah complex thing. Harry Potter pulled that exact same nonsense, and that boy had some issues, okay? Anyways, speaking about family, when the first Congress, like, adjourned or whatever, Johnny freaking put a ring on his girlfriend, Dorothy. I know what you're thinking. How many babies did they pop out? 7, 8, 10? No. This was a forward-thinking suburban family. They had two kids, Lydia, who died 10 months after birth, and Johnny Jr., who died when he was 9 years old in some freak ice skating accident.
Insert useless, insensitive Tanya Harding joke here.
Now it's the part you've been waiting for. It's time to talk the tea. So, Johnny Hancocky was the treasurer of some fancy university. I think it's called Harvard, something like that. And he had all the money records, and he was loaned, like, $15,000 to handle the money stuff. Well then, boom, 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 Lexington and Concord throws America into a freaking war, and Johnny runs off to his new president of the Congress job without paying back the money or giving back the account information. Later on, Johnny's political nemesis, James Bowdoin,
gathers up a bunch of Harvard bigwigs and they track Johnny all the way to freaking Philadelphia to make him pay up. And he was like super embarrassed. So he did pay a little bit over the original amount, but he didn't return all the records and he didn't pay the freaking interest either. And he kept on not paying until he freaking died. And his estate had to pay the rest of the interest. Moral of the story? College loans have never been fair, even for the wealthiest of the wealthy. But anyways, Johnny Hancocky was the prez of the Congress through some of the toughest times. When the tea sippers took over freaking New Jersey and New York, Johnny was there, writing letters, trying to get some food, trying to get some people, trying to get some money. He was there when the Congress had to literally run away twice. All right, so you've probably been thinking about something this entire freaking episode, like something that you would probably give me a 1-star review over in iTunes if I didn't talk about it, and that's the signature thing. Okay, so if you were to actually look at the signatures on the Declaration of Independence for once in your life, you'll see that Johnny Hancocky's Johnny Hancocky is, well, quite cocky. No, really. His signature is so freaking bougie and extra. It became a meme to the point where John Hancock's freaking name is a synonym for signature. No, don't remember him for being the president of the Congress during the craziest time of the war. No, remember him for his freaking penmanship. Americans, I tell ya. There's even this ridiculous, unfounded rumor that Johnny signed his name all big so that King George wouldn't need his glasses to read it. Also, if you think everybody met up in Starbucks and bought some venti espresso creamsicle coffees and signed the Declaration of Independence at the same freaking time, you're absolutely 100% incorrect. No. Johnny Hancocky, who was the president of the freaking Congress, was the first to sign the first copy. Then it got sent around, and only his name was on it. And it wasn't even signed, it was printed on. The super famous signed copy happened like 6 months later, where someone painstakingly hand-wrote the thing, and they took whoever was in the room at the time, it was all like, sign the thing. This copy happened on freaking July 19th, okay? Don't get it twisted. Okay, so after like 2 years of being all super Congress or whatever, Johnny kind of got tired and bored and asked for a vacation, and he went home to Massachusetts. His buddy Sammy Adams hated him at this point. He thought Johnny was too bougie to care about the common man like a true Republicanist should. Yeah, like when Congress was all like, let's send him a thank you card. Sammy Adams didn't sign. When Johnny came home, he got thrown back into the House of Reps for Massachusetts. He gave money to poor people, to widows, to orphans, to friends who needed a quick dollar. He, even after he splurged it all on the war. What a stand-up guy. After a little bit, he was a delegate for Continental Con once again, but he immediately entered sore loser mode when they straight up made someone else president of the Continental Con while he was gone. Shoulda seen it coming. Man, politicians are, and always will be, Taylor Swifty snakes. Yeah, and he kept getting into fights with his old buddy Sammy Adams, and he was homesick. I mean, he signed the Articles of Confetti while he was there, if that means anything, but he was unhappy. So he went back home. He wanted to be a general, and he got what he wanted, but he sucked at it. Like, basically, all of the 6,000 people he was leading, all the 6,000 people he was leading deserted. Probably because they were doing whatever the French general was doing, because Johnny wasn't doing his job, and the French general decided to abandon the attack. I mean, it was embarrassing, but everybody still liked good old Johnny Hancocky. Like, Massachusetts got a new constitution, and like, 90% of the people elected Johnny as the freaking governor. And it made sense, too. Look at all the stuff he did at Continental Con. James Baudouin doesn't even measure up. The 10% who did like Baudouin, who are all just a bunch of rich people on the coastline,
They thought Johnny was too bougie and liked poor people too much. And, like, Johnny just kept getting elected governor over and over and over and over and over and over and over again. He didn't do much, though. Like, he didn't do anything wrong as the governor because he actively avoided the hot-button issues where he might accidentally do something wrong. And everybody kept liking him. No, but, like, he suddenly resigned, okay? And he was all like, quote, I'm sick. I have the gout. I guess I have to freaking resign from office. Unquote. Maybe he realized people were starting to notice that he wasn't solving any problems, so he played the sick card and got out of there. Kinda weird how his gout always flared up when something controversial was happening. Yeah. James Baldwin ended up taking his place just in time for freaking Shay's Rebellion, which involved guns and happened because the poor people were being asked to pay for everything with currency and not the harvest. And after that whole thing happened, Johnny ran for governor and won again and kept being the governor for the rest of his freaking life. Holy guacamole, Johnny, that was so sneaky! So, he resigned as governor and headed back to Continental Con, which was now called Confetti Con because of the articles of confetti. I mean, at this point, none of the states really cared about or needed Congress anymore, so he easily got to be the president of the Congress again. But he never showed up because of his gout, and he signed a resignation letter that said, quote, "Thanks for the offer, but my gout hurts," unquote. While he was being the governor of Massachusetts, the Articles of Confetti were replaced with this Constitution thing in Philly. He couldn't be there in person because of the gout, but the final copy did land on his table. At first, he didn't like it. But then, he watched some crazy debates because he was elected as president of the Let's Debate This New Constitution Committee. And after all that yelling, he made a speech that was all like, quote, "Look, I'm sick and tired, and you're yelling too loud, so let's just ratify it. We'll look like a really nice country, and unified and stuff, and not a bunch of states, you feel me?" Unquote. And then, his backstabbing friend, Sammy Adams, agreed with him! Finally! After years! And then Massachusetts agreed to sign the Constitution, narrowly, but still they agreed! And then someone put his name into the Goblet of Fire to run for president of the whole country in the very first election, and this is where we stop. Yep, I will say no more. Whew, that was a long one. But thanks for sticking it out with me. If you've got something to say about this episode, about the podcast, or about, I don't know, Dragon Ball FighterZ, you can find Garble Twistery on Facebook or Twitter, or you can head to garbletwistery.net and send a message in the contact section, or you can email moi. My email is Rafiq, that's R-A-F-I-Q at garbletwistery.net. Next time, we're looking at candidate number 5, Johnny. No, absolutely not. There are only 4 candidates named Johnny. No, look at some dude named Samuel. Samuel Huntington, get hype, bro, potatoes. We've passed the halfway point.
This is the ending. I'm ending it now.
And you should probably swim back to Traderland where you can get all the overpriced tea you want.